Good morning and good afternoon, everybody. Today is going to be our second part of our Haggadah Shurim. For those who are interested, you can find the recording of last week's shiur on YU Torah. That was part one of Haggadah Highlights, where we shared four what I think were great and fascinating ideas on the opening sections of the Haggadah through the Karpas. And now we are ready for the Maggid section. And my hope, Emir Tzashem, is between this shiur and then next week, we'll have time for one more shiur before Pesach. So we'll altogether have three Haggadah Shurim. And this one today, we'll do four ideas from the beginning of Maggid. And then Emir Tzashem, next week, we'll do three or four new ideas, more ideas, additional ones from the remaining sections of Maggid. So let's start with our first one for today, right at the outset of Maggid. As you know, every year we begin the Maggid section of the Haggadah with the famous paragraph, Halach Ma'anya D'Achla Avosanu Ba'ara Dimitrayim. This is a Aramaic tefillah. We'll get back to the Aramaic part in a minute. That's actually a significant part of what I want to discuss. But in this Aramaic tefillah, we describe three basic themes. Basically, we start off by talking about the matzah, that this is the matzah that our forefathers ate in Mitzrayim. The next thing we do is kol dichvin yesev yechol, kol ditzrech yesev yifsach. The second thing we do is we invite anyone who's needy, anyone who's hungry to come join us in the meal. And then the third thing we do is hashta hacha l'shana haba ba'ara di Yisrael, hashta avde l'shana haba b'nei chorin. The third section of Halach Ma'anya is where we invoke the idea of l'shana haba b'Yerushalayim. We hope for the better future. We hope that next year we're all in Yerushalayim with the Beis HaMikdash. So a short paragraph written in Aramaic with three themes. And basically, I think one could ask at least three questions on this very brief paragraph. Number one, as I've already alluded to, why is it in Aramaic? No obvious reason why this should be in Aramaic. If you'll tell me that was the vernacular at some point in history, so the obvious question would still be Mimanavshach. If it's important to have it in the vernacular, so then why isn't the whole Haggadah in the vernacular? And if it's not so important, why dafka this paragraph? And should we all be saying it in English or Yiddish or some other language? Why is this dafka, this paragraph, in Aramaic and somehow still in Aramaic? Very, very bizarre. Secondly, as I quickly ran through the paragraph and the three points mentioned, all three of these themes are fine in and of themselves, but there doesn't seem to be any coherent connection between the three themes. We describe what matzah is, that matzah that our forefathers ate in Egypt. We talk about inviting guests to our Seder, and then we say L'shana Habab Yerushalayim. All three of these things are fine in and of themselves, but it's not clear what the connection is, what theme there is from one to the other. And then lastly, a question which I think is on everyone's mind, and probably in many Haggadahs or many Siddurim people discuss this, is the whole idea of the invitation seems to make no sense. I mean, it's nice to invite guests, but to invite guests when we're already sitting at our table, we've already made Kiddush, we're all around our Seder table, with the door closed, and wherever we find ourselves, seems a bit disingenuous and a little bit fake. You know, if we really want to invite guests, shouldn't we be doing that way before the Seder, and certainly way before the beginning of Maggid? So, in order to answer all three of these questions, I want to share with you an idea that I saw in the name of a very incredible perush on the Haggadah, called the Maisa Nisim, which is written by a very important, although not so well-known, Rav from the 16th century, named Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi, author of the Maisa Nisim. Interesting person. If we had more time, we'd go into his biography, but the brief shiur does not allow for that. But the Maisa Nisim, Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi, 16th century, he makes the following observation in general, and as it relates to Halach Ma'anya. He says, until we reach the final redemption, Mashiach, the third Beis HaMikdash, Ala Gittazacha, and all the good things we hope for and daven for, until we get to that point, until we get to the final Geula, we should have some level of mixed feelings at the Seder. On the one hand, there's much to celebrate. We left Mitzrayim, we became the chosen nation, the Am HaNivchar, we received the Torah, many, many points in our history. The Jewish people were sitting down to a Seder in relative security and even in some cases wealth and prosperity. But on the other hand, no matter how great things have been at any given time, we can't act as if things are perfect. We can't act if things are all good and that nothing is missing. We have to remember at all times that until the final Geula, the Beis HaMikdash, Mashiach, Jewish sovereignty, all that stuff, it's missing. We're missing the final piece. And we can never forget that. Just like, as we all know, perhaps most well-known from the Jewish life cycle, the idea of Zecher L'Churban is mentioned in the Gemara in many contexts, but perhaps the one that still remains relatively popular and observed and is most well-known to all of us, of course, is the custom that we have, and we all observe this, at the end of a chuppah, at a wedding, we break the glass. And even though there are other reasons given for breaking the glass at the chuppah, but certainly one popular reason, as it's usually known, is Zecher L'Churban, that even the moments, right, in many cases you'll have a rabbi or somebody under the chuppah explaining this to everyone, that even at our moments of our greatest joy, we have to remember that nothing is perfect, nothing is complete if we're missing the Beis HaMikdash, if we're missing the final Geula. In that sense, says the Ma'aseh Nisim, Halach Ma'anya is the broken glass. Halach Ma'anya serves the same role at the Seder, something that's otherwise a crescendo of Jewish celebration and experience. Halach Ma'anya serves the same role at the Seder that breaking the glass should serve at the wedding. It's written in Aramaic specifically, he explains, because this was the language spoken in Bavel, in Babylonia, where our first Golus was. So no matter where we are in history, no matter what language we speak, we always say this paragraph specifically, Dafken Aramaic, to remind us of Bavel, to remind us of Babylonia, and our first Golus. Because by doing so, hopefully that triggers and reminds us, no matter how comfortable we may be now, we all remain in an exiled state, a state of Golus, which is one long continuation, despite the various interruptions, including the brief respite of Bayis Sheni, that we all are in that exiled state. So that answers our first question, why it's in Aramaic. But he continues and explains that this is why we declare that matzah is lach ma'anya, it's poor man's bread, and that this is what our forefathers ate in Mitzrayim. Because we're reminding ourselves that despite our relative wealth, there's still a fundamental similarity to our Seder and the first Seder the Jewish people had in Mitzrayim. And that is that even though we are experiencing some level of Geula, it's still not the Geula Shlema. It's still not complete. And we truly remind ourselves of this in a very dramatic way, albeit subtle, although now that you understand it, it won't be subtle anymore. This year, Halach Ma'anya will take on another significance for you, and that is that final part the middle part of Halach Ma'anya, where we invite people to the Seder. We mentioned it's kind of bizarre and seems a little bit fake. We're kind of posing, as we might say nowadays. Who are we inviting? Give me a break. No one's listening to us. No one's coming to the Seder then. So the Ma'aseh Nisim explains to it beautifully. As many of you probably know, the centerpiece of the Seder, of course, was the Korban Pesach. In the Beis HaMikdash, of course, it was all centered around the Korban Pesach. And one of the halachos of the Korban Pesach was it had to be eaten b'chabura. You had to sign up. You had to register with which group of people you were eating a particular animal. And you had to have signed up for that by Erev Pesach, by the time that the Korban Pesach was shechted. You can't just show up, whatever your excuse was. It doesn't matter how legitimate the excuse was, how busy you were, you had an emergency, it doesn't matter. If you just show up on Pesach night at a Seder and want to eat from someone's Korban Pesach, you're not allowed. Whether it's your fault or not, it doesn't matter. You're not allowed to participate. You have to be signed up. You have to be registered for a chabura in order to eat as part of the Korban Pesach. Therefore, explains Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi, in this particular part of the Haggadah, Halach Ma'anya, where Dafka highlighting, albeit subtly, but highlighting our exiled status, the fact that we're not in a position of Gula Shlema, it's Dafka in this paragraph, we extend this invitation. Of course it's not real, no one's listening to it, but we do it symbolically to remind ourselves that if someone were to come to the door, if we could invite someone, even at this last moment, they could join our Seder. They could eat matzah with us, they could eat mara with us, they could have korech with us, and of course they could have shulchan aruch with us. What would not have been true if there would be a Korban Pesach? What would not be true if there was a Beis HaMikdash? And ironically, even though it seems very nice that we could do hospitality and Hachnasas Orchim at the last minute nowadays, and we couldn't have done it then, but it's that discrepancy which reminds us that we are living in an imperfect, exiled state. Bisman HaMikdash, Bisman when there was a Korban Pesach, we would not have been able to invite someone at the last minute. This would have been totally inappropriate to say, Kol Dichvin Yesev Yechol. So we do a Dafka now in this paragraph, because part of the theme of Halach Ma'anya is to remind us that we are living in this exiled state. And last but not least, we come to the end of the Halach Ma'anya, Lashana Haba, where we mention Hashta Avdei, next year hopefully B'nai Chorin, this year wherever we are, hopefully next year Yerushalayim, and of course now it makes perfect sense why we're ending this paragraph of all paragraphs with this idea. Since the whole theme of Halach Ma'anya, explains Rabbi Elazar Ashkenazi, is to remind ourselves that as good as we have it, we don't have everything. So therefore, an expression in kiyum, in fulfillment of the famous teaching of Chazal and the Gemara in Tainis, that kol misabla al churbono zocha v'roa es simchasa, that by commemorating and remembering, even at our greatest joy, like the Seder, that things are not perfect, that we don't have a base of Mikdash yet, by reminding ourselves of that, by remembering and being misabel even a little bit on the Beis HaMikdash, hopefully we will be zoche v'roa simchasa, we will certainly be meriting the Lashana Haba. I think this is a really transformative insight into Halach Ma'anya. It answers all three of the individual questions, and really in a very profound way, completely, at least for me, I speak personally, revolutionizes my understanding and my appreciation of Halach Ma'anya, and this would be a Kedai insight to know any year. But obviously it takes on greater sensitivity and greater significance this year when, all of us have had our plans turned upside down. Many of us were going to be with extended family. Now this year we're not going to be. Some of us may have been in relative luxury of Pesach programs or all sorts of things. This year we're not going to be. All the things that we would have thought that we would have enjoyed. I'm not saying that they're inappropriate to enjoy those things. But let's be honest, each and every one of those things that we enjoy adds that much more to our difficulty in remembering what we don't have, and difficulty in truly feeling the chisaron of no Beis HaMikdash. This year, where we're all suffering, some unfortunately, chas v'shalom, some of us suffering even more than others, but all of us to one degree or another are suffering at the moment, it certainly is one that I think touches our heart, and this year, more than any other, it should not be hard for us to get in touch with the fact that hopefully, even within our nuclear families, as we make Seder alone, hopefully we'll make a beautiful Seder, but nevertheless, this year, more than any other, I think it should be not that hard for us to get in touch with this feeling that things are far from perfect. They're far from perfect last year also without a Beis HaMikdash. But this year, I think we'll really be able to relate to, and this insight of Rabbi Elazar Ashkenazi should truly be able to resonate with us, this insight, and at least for me, and I imagine for most of us, a new idea and a new understanding of Halach Ma'anya. Moving on, the next part of the Haggadah, of course, is the famous Ma'anish Tana, followed by what seems to be, or supposedly is the answer to the Ma'anish Tana, which is Avadim Hayinu. However, many of the Mefarshim point out, and again, for the sake of time, I won't belabor the point. I'm not going to review Ma'anish Tana or review Avadim Hayinu. We all are familiar with these paragraphs, two of the most well-known and beloved paragraphs and sections of the Haggadah. But many Mefarshim point out and ask that even though I described it ostensibly as the questions of Ma'anish Tana and the answer of Avadim Hayinu, the truth is that Avadim Hayinu is anything but. It actually doesn't seem to be an answer to the question whatsoever. In what way does Avadim Hayinu in any way directly answer any of the four questions or the overall question of Ma'anish Tana Halayla Hazeh Mikol HaLeilot? So there are many, many answers to this question, many, but I want to just share one in particular, which I think is both beautiful and also because it allows me an opportunity to share the name of a Haggadah, which I imagine most people are not so familiar with, and that is the Haggadah, which is called Haggadas Kama Malot, or Haggadas Kama Malos, if you prefer that pronunciation. This is the Haggadah that was put out by Rav Eli Sadan. Eli Sadan, for those of you not from Israel, maybe are less familiar, he is the founder of the entire Mechina movement, and the Rosh Yeshiva, and the founder of the Mechina in Eli, which was the founding, and probably to this day, considered the most prestigious of the Mechinot, and a significant, not only Talmud Chacham, but a significant, significant leader and personality in Eretz Yisrael. And he has a Haggadah, which was originally published in Hebrew, and you can also get it, I'm sure, for a small donation to Eli. You can even get that Haggadah in English now. Over the years, they have sent me both. So I think I gave away my English one to somebody, but I, at one point I had both. And in his Haggadah, he addresses this question: how does Avadim Hayinu serve as an answer or a response to the questions of Ma'anish Tana? After all, we ask some very specific questions, and instead of answering any of them, we go on to a tour of Jewish history. Avadim Hayinu lefar b'Mitzrayim, we were slaves, Hashem took us out with the Yad Chazakah, Zor Netuya. What does that have to do with anything? So Rav Sadan, and this is one of those ideas in which we would say in the Beis Medrash, Ra'ui l'misha omro, perfectly a fitting chiddush for the one who said it, because he's a master educator. He explains that this idea, this response of Halach of Avadim Hayinu, he says, is actually, in fact, very sound educational technique. He says all of the children's questions in the Ma'anish Tana focus on the details of the Seder. Anomalous details, things which don't make sense. Why are we leaning? Why are we dipping? Why are we eating this and not that? All about details. What and why we're doing what we're doing. When we answer the question, we are deliberately, says Rav Sadan, deliberately ignoring these details and first focusing on the larger more general issue of Jewish history, Jewish destiny, our place in history, and our larger relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which was formed through the Yetzias Mitzrayim, the wandering in the desert, the giving of the Torah, and eventual going into Eretz Yisrael. We do this, he says, because from an educational perspective, he points out the only way to properly understand the details of Jewish ritual practice, all the details of the mitzvos, is if only it's only possible to appreciate these and to have trust in those details if one first comes to understand and truly appreciate the big picture of Judaism and the big picture of Jewish history. If you separate the details from the general background of Jewish history and Jewish destiny, then no individual concept can be fully understood and no individual question can fully be answered. Only with an understanding and therefore hopefully an appreciation of the Jewish historical destiny and the Jewish historical mission, as symbolized the story beginning with Avadim Ayinu, only in that context can someone, a child or an adult, truly eventually appreciate all the details, and will they have the natural trust in the halachic process, a trust in the Mesorah, a trust in our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, been forged through the fires of Mitzrayim and so many other fires and hells throughout Jewish history, and the continuing and constant love that Hashem has had, never leaving our side. Only when we're introduced to and hopefully appreciate and trust in that larger Jewish historical narrative and the Jewish destiny, only then can we truly understand, appreciate, and even trust when we don't understand all the individual details and the specific details of halachic practice. And therefore, he says, that's the first thing we do. We don't start by getting into a pill pool of in chakiras, in details of halachos based on his questions. That won't work. Rather, we start with this introduction to Jewish history, and then eventually, towards the end of the Haggadah, then we explain, why do we eat matzah? Why do we eat maror? Why do we do this? Why do we do that? But all of that comes, but it only comes after our initial, more general response of Avadim Ayinu, recounting the drama that gave birth to the Jewish people. And even then, Rav Sadan adds, it should be noted, even then, we never give direct explanations to these secondary practices of dipping and leaning. The other two questions, matzah and maror, we address directly, because those are very, very central. But the more secondary things of afilu pamachas, the dipping and the leaning, those we don't actually ever address directly, because we expect that those details will be understood naturally through the experience of the Seder. So in other words, says Rav Sadan, again, this is a point which could be the basis of an hour shiur about education and about parenting, and now I'm just kind of dropping it on you and hopefully whetting your appetite as a little bit of a teaser, but this basic point is that to truly understand, to get buy-in, whether it's our children or for that matter ourselves or our students in the community, from all the details of halacha, you can't separate that from the larger appreciation of Jewish history, our long-term relationship through history with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the lived experience of our mitzvah life, of our ritual life. So we start off with the history, and even then, even after we start giving answers, we hope that some of the questions will be answered mimela through the experience. To separate experience and historical consciousness and sensitivity on the one hand from ritual practice and mitzvahs on the other hand is a mistake, which unfortunately many of us in various educational institutions and communities, whether they're in Eretz Yisrael or Chutz La'aretz, unfortunately, some of us have been educated in ways that didn't necessarily take these lessons to heart. And sometimes, unfortunately, we've seen the karbonos that can come from that. So that is his very, very intriguing educational philosophy, which emerges, in his opinion, in his theory, out of the Haggadah's almost non-answer to the questions of Ma'anish Tana, the indirect response of Avadim Ayinu. Okay, continuing on, a third idea. We say there at the end of Avadim Ayinu, we mentioned the famous phrase, afilu kulanu chachamim, kulanu nevonim, kulanu zekenim. No matter how smart we were, no matter how wise we were, no matter how learned we were, even if we knew everything, kol haTorah kula, mitzvah aleinu lesaper b'tzias Mitzrayim, we should still be doing Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, the same thing we were doing when we were in kindergarten and in first and second grade. We have to do the same thing even now, no matter how learned we are. What is the point of this? What is this telling us? So one possible answer could be, very simply, that this is just an expression of the Jewish people being the people of the book. We have a thirst for knowledge. That's a general Jewish trait. And it's being mentioned here, you know, because why not? But presumably, there should be more than that. We would like to think that there's a more, if it's in the Haggadah, in such an early stage of Magid, we would like to assume that there's a more direct connection between this general idea of always thirsting for knowledge and specifically the mitzvah, which we're just in the beginning stages of trying to fulfill at the Seder, which is the mitzvah d'oraisa of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. So this year, I bought the Rabbi Frand Haggadah. I believe it came out a few years ago, but I actually just bought it this year. One of the benefits of living in Baltimore was I got a chance to meet and have a personal relationship for a number of years with Rabbi Frand. And this Haggadah is, you know, very much captures his spoken word. This wasn't a Haggadah that he wrote, I don't think, per se. It seems like it was kind of a write-up of things that he gave orally, which is his famous strength. And it really does capture what makes him such a powerful vehicle for Torah learning for already quite a few decades in America and the worldwide over. I certainly recommend the Haggadah. Generally and specifically on page 70 or so, he addresses this question. What is this idea of Kulan Chachavim Nevonim, this idea that we always need to learn more and more and more? What's that got to do with Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim? And he shares the following idea. When Moshe was at the burning bush, going back all the way to the beginning of the story, Perek Gimel, Mishnah, Pasuk Gimel and Shmos, when Moshe is at the burning bush, he notices, and it says in the Pasuk, Asurana v'ere. Moshe says, I'll turn to the side and I'll look. Madua lo yivar hasna. Why the bush is not being consumed. And in response to that, the Pasuk continues, and Kadosh Baruch Hu reveals himself, Vayikra elav Elokim mitoch hasna. God calls out to Moshe from the bush. The Medrash in the Yalkut Shemoni asks, why was Moshe Zoche? Why did he merit to have this divine revelation at the burning bush? Who is he? What had he done at that point in his life to merit this revelation? And the Medrash gives two incredibly surprising and underwhelmingly, it would seem, underwhelming answers. The first opinion is that when Moshe saw the burning bush, he took three steps towards the bush. It's those three steps, says the Medrash in its first opinion, why Moshe was Zoche to get this revelation. That seems quite underwhelming and unimpressive, but that's the Medrash's first opinion. The second opinion in the Medrash is even more surprising because it seems to be even more underwhelming. The second opinion in the Medrash says, you know why Moshe merited the revelation? Because when he saw the burning bush or it caught his attention, he was literally walking in the other direction. But he turned around, he craned his neck, as it were, to look towards the bush. And according to the second opinion, that's why he merited this zchus. Again, two opinions in the Yalkut Shemoni there in Shmos. So how is it possible? How do we understand this Medrash? Why would these very minimal actions be enough to merit such a revelation from HaKadosh Baruch Hu? So Rabbi Frand quotes the Chevron Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Simcha Zissel Broida. I didn't have a chance to look it up inside, but I'm assuming that he's quoting from Rav Broida's Sfarim Sam Derech, which were his shiurim that he gave in the Chevron Yeshiva on Chumash, which were published in a multi-volume set by Machon Yerushalayim. I happen to have the set. I just didn't have a chance to look it up inside today, but I have a feeling that's where Rabbi Frand is probably quoting from. But Rabbi Frand quotes from this Rosh Yeshiva, Zatzal, Rav Simcha Zissel, the following explanation. Why is it that such minimal actions, three steps, turning your head, craning your neck, why should that be enough to be Zoche to a revelation? So he says very simple, simple but significant. He said Judaism is predicated and contingent on a lifelong thirst for growth and knowledge. Even though at that point Moshe was already 80 years old, he didn't say, this is who I am who I am. Like many of us do, we get to a certain age of life and our growth period is over and kind of the rest of our life is just about hopefully not slacking off, not shrinking, not getting smaller. Moshe, even at 80 years old, which was 10 years older than what was certainly, as we write in Tehillim, of a Shivim Shana, if 70 years is considered the average lifespan, he's already 10 years past that. He didn't say, I am who I am, what do I need to know anymore, what do I need to change? Even though he was 80, he still had a curiosity and a thirst for knowledge. The Psikta, another Medrash there in Shmos, says, amazingly, that other shepherds had already been past that spot, other shepherds had already seen the same bush, and it didn't stop. Even though the bush was burning and not being consumed, and other shepherds saw it, they kept on walking. They couldn't be bothered. What was the big deal? Who knows what the explanation was? We all often, we see things in life that pique our curiosity, but in a millisecond, we forget them and we keep on going because we're too busy. And that happened to other shepherds, says the Medrash. But Moshe, he stopped. They didn't even turn their neck, but he did. And whether it was the three steps or the turning of the neck, it wasn't that, obviously, per se. What the Medrash is getting at is that small action symbolized the deeper commitment that Moshe had, that he was always looking to grow, always looking to learn. And that's why he was Zoche to this revelation at the burning bush. Rabbi Fran adds that this might also explain something that I discussed in my shul a few weeks ago, Parshas Ki Tisa. That was the last Shabbos that my shul was open. And there we read, of course, about how Moshe came down from the mountain and his face had a shine, Karan or Panav. Where did the shine come from? When he went up to the mountain, there was no rays of light. How come when he came down? So the Medrash famously says there was some leftover ink in the quill that Moshe had used to write the Torah, and from that leftover ink, there was the shine. So the question is, what do you mean leftover ink? HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave him a pen, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave him the ink, HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't know how much ink was needed for the Torah. Why didn't Hashem should have given Moshe the exact right amount of ink? If there's leftover ink, does that mean that HaKadosh Baruch Hu made a mistake, that he put too much ink in there? So there are many answers to the question, and now I'm not sharing with you the one that I gave over in my shul when I was speaking about Corona a few weeks ago, but in this context, Rabbi Fran mentions that perhaps the idea of the leftover ink is exactly in keeping with what we're seeing until now, that the extra ink was put in on purpose by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, symbolizing that even after you've gone through the whole Torah, even after you think you've learned it all, there's always still a little bit of ink left. There's always more you can learn. There's always more makoros, more sources that you haven't seen. And even if you've seen that pasuk and you've seen the Mishnah and you've seen the Gemara already 100 times, each time we all know this, each time we see a text anew, we're always another level of insight, another level of understanding. And therefore Moshe, from the very beginning, symbolized this idea of always coveting more and more knowledge, coveting the extra drop of ink, always wanting to learn more. And this, Rabbi Fran suggests, perhaps this is why at the early stage here, at the outset of Magid, we're saying at the Seder that afilu kohanu chachamim klam nevonim, it's not just an incidental point, that it's a general Jewish value, which is incidental to the Seder, but on the contrary, it gets to the heart of the Seder story, because it goes back to the beginning of when Moshe was zocha to become the Roa Neman, to become not only the shepherd of that sheep, but the shepherd of the flock of the Jewish people. He was zocha to it because he had this thirst. No matter how much he thought he was, he still felt the need to do more, and that's what we tell ourselves as we review this story, a ritual we do over and over, year after year after year, and yet there's still more to learn, more insights to have in the Seder. So I think we've gone far enough. I apologize for going a little longer than usual, but 3, I hope, great and intriguing ideas to help you with your Seder. Yemir Tzeh Hashem, in terms of a Haggadah, we'll be back next week, either Monday or Tuesday. I'm not sure yet which day. We'll be back next week with our 3rd and final Haggadah highlights. Thank you very, very much, and have a great day.